From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of some of the stories making their way through the international news sections of the media with Mark Sloboda, international affairs expert and senior lecturer at Moscow State University, who spoke with us live from Moscow on Monday. Mark, welcome back. Pleasure to have you.
Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR with you.
And our pleasure and honor also. Let's, I guess we want to do a quick run around of the scene first, and then we can talk about Syria.
Yeah, Iran and the U.S. tensions, of course, aren't going away anywhere. There have been suggestions via the Trump administration that Trump could talk to the Iranian President Rouhani. Rouhani initially suggested that a day earlier that he might be willing to talk to Trump. This was itself a turnaround from earlier statements that Rouhani, that the U.S. and Iran have nothing to talk about. And then immediately after this, when the U.S. Sounded some tentative suggestions that they might take Iran up on that, then Rouhani announced that there would be no talks between Iran and the U.S. until all sanctions on Iran were lifted, until the economic war that the U.S. has unilaterally instigated on Iran after pulling out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. There would be no talks until then. There's no point in it. Besides the fact that it's obvious that the Trump administration can't be trusted, and that Iran, after having sat down and agreed with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with President Obama after years of dealings, of negotiations to get there, that they feel that they can't trust any American government. You know, whether they can trust one individual government at any one moment in time, they now understand that the next government that takes power could easily, reverse all of that process.
Well, so, I mean, anybody with a history book could have some concern about trusting the U.S. government.
And they could, but sometimes it takes some personal experience.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to remember that President Rouhani and his crew are what is considered moderates in Iran. And they were elected with a fairly significant margin because they promised that they could get the previous round of sanctions lifted and cut a deal with Obama on the nuclear deal. You know, I mean, I always regard this as a bit of economic blackmail. The U.S. has long known, and U.S. intelligence agencies have repeatedly reported, that Iran had no nuclear weapons program. They had a civilian nuclear program. The sanctions, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the sanctions before it, were all intended to limit Iran's civilian nuclear program to within limits that would prevent reaching what is called a breakout technology, where Iran would have enough legal, completely legal under the UN's nuclear non-proliferation deals, that would give Iran the capability within a short period of time, within 2 or 3 years, to then develop a nuclear weapon if they so desired. Right. That is what the new bar. Not that Iran is building nuclear weapons, but they have the civilian nuclear technology and capability to, in a relatively short period of time, right, i.e. 2 or 3 years, to build a nuclear weapon if they did start a program. That was right. What it was all intended to do. So they elected, the Iranian people elected a group of moderates led by Rouhani that – you know, basically promised to cut a deal with Obama on this, and then that Iran would accept limitations to their civilian nuclear power program and extensive oversight by the International Atomic Energy Agency with all kinds of inspections and whatnot, limitations on the amount and the degree of enriched uranium they could keep on hand, how they could get rid of the excess, so on and so on.
Before you travel into this part, it's just that I want to make an observation, which is, you know, because you said it twice, and I hear it all the time, and even if you go to Wikipedia, etc., you know, the word moderate is such an interesting word, you know, and kind of decontextualized, because on the one hand, they refer to him as a moderate as against Ahmadinejad, who's the person he ran against last, I believe. That was the last election. And the former president there. And that is over things like relations with the United States, pushing for this particular deal, etc. But also, in another context, he wouldn't be the moderate between the two, but Ahmadinejad would be, and actually was referred to that during Ahmadinejad's time, because he was a secular. And Rouhani, you know, comes out, he's a cleric, but he also is part of the group that actually made the post-revolutionary period, that made an Islamic Republic. He was one of the members of the ruling council, helped organize the military and all of that. So, I mean, I'm just saying it's such a weird thing for people here to hear moderate, and they don't really understand it because they don't know the background, but the word is a very elastic one, isn't it?
Yeah, being a fan of the secular Ahmadinejad, I completely agree with you that when we've adopted, I guess, I adopted the language of the Western press when talking about Iranian political figures. And you're right, what is considered a moderate is based solely on their intention of engagement with the United States and, you know, you could say the West in general, the U.S.-led West. And that is what is defined as a moderate. Right. Whereas Ahmadinejad, who was a secular, very, very, very pro-socialistish type economics, you know, working class, was regarded as a hardliner because of his, and a conservative because of his confrontational. Although, you know, in terms of social mores and, you know, Iran and religion and whatnot, you probably would not refer to Ahmadinejad as a conservative or a hardliner. So,
on the question of, for example, can we reopen a couple of pubs in Tehran?
Yeah,
Ahmadinejad was accused of allowing that, and of course, Rouhani is a cleric. No.
Yeah, so. I think you're right. We do have to be careful of our language when we refer to moderates and hardliners and conservatives.
Okay, go ahead.
But there's no question that whatever people who are critical of Iranian engagement with the West, which is a significant part of the Iranian government and political elite, were kind of waiting for Rouhani to fail. Right. Because they said you can't trust the U.S. and your attempt to deal with them is not going to gain us anything. And sure enough, Trump comes along and pulls out a joint comprehensive plan of action. And after Rouhani had a first turnaround and signaled even slightly that he might be willing to talk with the U.S., even if there was only a 10% chance of success, he said, of, you know, ending the sanctions. Several prominent conservative newspapers, one affiliated with religious hardliners, another one that is politically connected with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, they both took out front page articles and ads condemning Rouhani for willing to be engaged and for sending the Iranian foreign minister Zarif to Paris to meet with the G7, basically pointing out that Rouhani is on fragile domestic political ground, not only among the political elite, but also among public opinion, because, you know, everything that, you know, he promised is up in flames, and certainly the Iranian economy is Pompeo said he wanted to make it scream, and that the Iranian government had better fall in line with the U.S., not just on nuclear issues, but on foreign policy throughout the region, meaning Hezbollah and in Syria and in Iraq and on their ballistic missile program, seeking to limit, Iranian ability to defend themselves. You know, who's allowed, not only who can and can't have nuclear technology now, but who and can't have technology to put missiles, military use, rockets into space, etc. You know, the U.S. is seeking to dictate all of that. So Rouhani's in domestic a tough spot. On another front with Iran, this oil tanker that was Iranian-owned oil tanker carrying Iranian oil that was seized in Gibraltar nearly 2 months ago now, which then resulted in the Iranian government seizing a British-flagged tanker in the Straits of Hormuz that they said was smuggling oil illegally. The Gibraltar authorities, presumably, with the say-so from the British government, Boris Johnson, let the Iranian tanker go. It was being held on very flimsy circumstances. The application of EU sanctions, not against Iran, but against Syria, to an Iranian vessel. And the last time I checked, Iran was not part of the EU.
Right. He asked Turkey about that.
And the Iranian ship was going through the Straits of Gibraltar, which is supposed to be an international straits with right of passage. Right. Anyway, the British Royal Marines stormed the ship by helicopter, all right, and seized the ship. And they it came down to a fine point because, you know, the EU is not a party to new U.S. sanctions against Iran. What they said was that this tanker's oil was bound for one particular oil refinery in Syria where economic aid to the company that controls that refinery is under sanctions by the EU. You're not allowed to give them economic assistance aid.
Right.
That sort of thing. It's really weird because while EU sanctions do prohibit the purchase of oil from Syria, never mind that the U.S. is actually controlling most of the oil in Syria with their occupation of east of the Euphrates, but that but nothing about oil from other countries going to Syria, and this is the way they kind of fine-tuned it. Anyway, for whatever reason, whether it was the Iranians seizing a vessel in response, the change in Boris Johnson's position, the tanker was let go with promises that were very fine in saying that they wouldn't go to that refinery in the detail, but were widely reported in the press that the tanker would not go to Syria. The kind of a misreporting there were widely across the media. And of course, what was really said between the Iranian government and the Gibraltar authorities and courts is a matter of a lot of conjecture.
Right.
Anyway, the tanker set sail after a little over a week, despite U.S. demands that it be seized. That they not let it go and that they turn it over to the U.S. Gibraltar ignored that, released it. It set sail for Greece, and then it was making way towards Cyprus, and then perhaps to Turkey, and then it was reported at the just over the weekend to be off the coast of Lebanon, which is just north of Syria, of course. And at least in most recent hours, I saw that it was actually off the coast of Syria itself, and perhaps heading to Tartus, which is right. a Syrian port, which also has a small Russian naval base there. Okay. I guess that's kind of a finger, a middle finger raised to the EU over Iran's the EU telling Iran who and who it can't sell oil to.
And this is including one at least one knuckle of that finger is Boris Johnson, which is cute. And you can guess probably. That was done in consultation with Trump, which raises a couple questions. Number one, the U.S. demand to, turn over this, seize the ship and all of that. How up or down the food chain is that decision from? And is Trump playing a virtual game here, or is this just Johnson on his own? I don't know. There's some play in there that I might be going on to.
Both governments are in chaos at the point. Boris Johnson just recently being the second unelected prime minister of the UK now dealing with Brexit, and he's being accused of a coup in the UK by preventing Parliament from meeting before a crucial October 31st deadline where it seems Boris Johnson is headed towards a hard Brexit. He called for a Queen's speech at a time that would prevent Parliament from meeting again with enough time to try to stop a hard Brexit from happening, which a majority of Parliament seems inclined to if they were given the opportunity. So Boris Johnson is on flimsy control there, and he also seems to have conflicted relations with Trump.
Not that's predictable between those two, any
European. And Trump himself, I've long since stopped believing anything Trump tweets or says himself, or that officials within his government say, even such figures as Bolton, as because no one seems to be definitively in charge of Trump's foreign policy.
It's still being decided, I think, for sure.
I think every issue is argued and swings back and forth.
Yeah, it could be.
Until either Trump himself or one of his neocon advisors or government figures manages to win on each political, each policy, foreign policy step, which may again change a week down the road.
Like a set of fractals, that are in constant turmoil or constant evolution change.
So a completely unstable government and foreign policy.
You could definitely use that word. Yep.
So that's the situation there. In Yemen, there's some interesting developments. The Houthis are touting their bringing down of another U.S. Reaper drone over Yemen, which, once again, the idea that the U.S. isn't militarily involved in Yemen is absurd.
Exactly.
They're aiding the Saudis, but, the fact that they keep losing their most advanced drones to Houthis, which
they're throwing spears practically.
A former student movement from the poorest country in the world, despite being under invasion from one of the richest countries in the world,
like
Saudi Arabia,
a couple years
doing
now.
This. Meanwhile, it appears the Saudi coalition and perhaps the Saudi invasion plans for Yemen to put their figurehead, Hadi, back on the presidential throne, as it were, in Yemen, are completely falling apart. The UAE has pulled out, the United Arab Emirates has pulled out of the Saudi coalition, and they were the second biggest partner there. Qatar pulled out long ago under political conflicts between their leader and the young chainsaw Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Bonesaw Prince, my apologies there, Mohammed bin Salman. And now the UAE has pulled out. And evidently, the country seems to be splitting once again, with Saudi-backed forces and Saudi military forces and mercenaries there, apparently controlling next to nothing. But there seems to be a split between South Yemen, what are being called separatists in the Western press, being supported, kind of a local initiative supported now by the United Arab Emirates against the force is controlled by the Saudi government, and the north, controlled by the Houthis largely, and various tribes that form up their coalition. And we're looking at, once again, a kind of a north-south Yemen split that may be happening, while, you know, the Saudi invasion force and the remnants of the forces that they back in the country seem to control next to nothing, and will have very little say about what happens forward. And with this split with the UAE, the Saudi government, after having spent so much money in their failed attempt to conquer and pacify Yemen and put their own person back in the president's seat, you know, it seems they're giving signals that they're willing to negotiate. And I think that we may see the beginning of the end of the Saudi occupation and invasion of Yemen. I mean, Yemen has a long, hard road ahead of it, and that won't certainly be the end of their problems. But it seems that Saudi, at least at some level, is recognizing that that they can't win, and that they've spent so much money and political capital on this that it's been disastrous for them.
Well, there was, you know, the land. This is really a legacy, because the in a way, anyway, and probably to the extent there's any infrastructure that exists, that it exists and it's replicated in this as well. You know, we had Yemen and South Yemen, and one of them was part of the Western Bloc. That was the, you know, part closest to Saudi Arabia. Then it was a breakaway Southern Republic from like 1968 until a merger in the 90s. That was a socialist country and was a part of the socialist bloc, the Eastern Bloc. You know, the Warsaw Pact, where you know, they had relations with them.
So yeah. We're seeing that split again, right, just on different terms, you know, really posing the question once again in the post-Cold War world, was it really about capitalist versus communist ideology, right, or was it more about realist geopolitical positions,
right,
that were just expressed through the ideological prism?
Right. Yeah, I think it certainly raises the question, doesn't it? What else we got?
On to Ukraine.
Oh boy.
The actor, comedian turned president of the this you know, rather Ukrainian state in very hard terms, 5 years after their U.S.-backed so-called Revolution of Dignity with the Maidan. So the new Rada, dominated by Zelensky's new party, the Servant of the People, which doesn't have a specific policy or platform other than being loyal to, you know, the new cult of personality around Zelensky, and consisting largely of political novices, they took their seats, right, on August 29th. So they're officially the Rada of Ukraine now, after many of them took a snap course on politics and how to run a government run by one of Ukraine's universities, because most of the a great deal of the people have no political knowledge or experience whatsoever.
Well, some of them saw Zelensky on TV, so they know what the president does.
Yeah, well, Zelensky knows what to do because he did play the president on TV, right? So they took office, and they've started a number of reforms, one of them being removing immunity from both the Rada itself and from the president's office, and perhaps from some judges as well, which was what one of Zelensky's campaign promises, which, no matter, you know, which way Zelensky falls on other issues, that does seem to be a positive step for Ukraine on there. That's still in the first reading. It's got to go through several more votes before it is actually approved. There was a lot of talk about a prisoner swap between Ukraine and Russia that would involve the Ukrainian political prisoner, the journalist Kirill Vyshinsky, who is a dual citizen of Ukraine. He's from East Ukraine and from Russia, who worked for a Russian state news agency as a journalist. He was imprisoned already a couple of years now on terms that, because his writing was critical of the Poroshenko government and supported the people of Donbass, what are referred to as Russian-backed separatists in the Western press. He was a traitor. It was treason. And he was, made a political prisoner there. And on the other side, there's a number of Ukrainian sailors who are still held in Russia after that provocation attempt by Poroshenko when he sent them into the Straits of Azov, not abiding by the agreed-upon treaties and procedures between the two countries long-standing to passage those dangerous straits, seeming to create a small military confrontation in an attempt to buttress Poroshenko's failed presidential bid to play on his campaign as religion, military, fatherland, his nationalist campaign. That seems to have failed, but there's still 20-some Ukrainian sailors, including three members of Ukrainian's intelligence services, the SBU, who just happened to be on the boats at that time. They're still being held, and Ukraine would like to get them and several other people back. But the prisoner swap is stalled after announcements that it was actually taking place and already on its way, and then it was called back. And no, it's not happening yet. They're still in negotiations. So it seems a little bit of chaos in the Ukrainian press there.
There's an interesting piece that went last week. It was in the Washington Post. It was an editorial piece. And, Washington Post, when I see the editorials there, I'm thinking this was written in Langley, period. They paid for it, for Christ's sake. They just bought the space. And it admonishes Zelensky over like a half a dozen points, in his opening period as president. And the first sin that he commits, according to the Washington, according to the CIA, whatever, is attempting to help Trump with information on Biden, on Biden's son, with all of that stuff. And they go through these other things, and I won't go into that here, but it says, finally, Zelensky's efforts to reset relations with Putin have brought few results. Soon after he entered office, Zelensky decided to launch a strategy of direct phone diplomacy with Putin.
Well, that's nonsense. Poroshenko talked on the phone far more with Putin than Zelensky did, and he actually didn't talk to Putin until more than a month, close to 2 months after taking office, even on the phone.
Which is interesting. Which is interesting because, but they're saying here,
nonsense.
So they're even misrepresenting the facts, and they're arguing basically that Ukraine should not directly engage Russia over Russia and Ukraine relations, because they get in the way of the U.S. negotiating Russia-Ukraine relations.
Yeah. Well, that actually fits exactly what Zelensky is doing.
Yeah, right.
Because he said that he wouldn't meet with Putin unless the president of the U.S., the prime minister of the U.K., the chancellor of Germany, and the president of France were all in the room to hold his hand.
Right.
And babysit him while he met with Putin. So
He owes Germany one too, by the way.
I don't even know what the Washington Post is complaining about.
I know.
Then because
this was last week.
Yeah, there is no attempt to reset relations with Russia so far by the Zelensky government.
Okay,
none.
So go
I mean,
ahead.
The most is these prisoner negotiations, but there were multiple rounds of prisoner negotiations between the previous government and Russia before. And, there have been prisoner releases previously on both sides, the forces engaged in the conflict, mostly between eastern Ukraine, the Donbass, and Ukraine, but, with Russia seen as certainly providing support for the people in Donbass there.
It's okay. Meanwhile, I just realized we've only got a minute left.
We
didn't even get to the main feast, which we'll do next week. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Zelensky's not going to meet with Trump after all. U.S. $250 million in military aid seems to be on pause, with Trump maybe not wanting to give it to Ukraine now. The new government includes a 35-year-old prime minister with no previous political experience, who was a real estate lawyer.
Wow.
The new defense minister was previously the Ukrainian ambassador to NATO. That tells you, on their foreign policy direction right there.
Right.
Most importantly, the interior minister, Avakov, who was in control of the Banderite battalions and their integration into police and military structures, is staying on. Zelensky will keep him, means that he is not going to challenge the Banderites in the country, at least right now.
Right.
He's not going to try to purge them.
We're going to have to pick it up here next week. Yeah, we got it. We got the picture. Thanks, Mark. Take care of yourself. See you next week.
See you next week.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.